Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio and a schedule of English language broadcast, or a computer or smartphone. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana, Cuba, and Russia's Sputnik Radio. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan, a brief update on the new coronavirus and Japanese plans to re-examine how to handle mass infections on cruise ships. The British government has new plans for issuing visas to foreign workers. Britain has urged Japan to raise its reduction target for greenhouse gas emissions. The Energy Observer is a hydrogen solar wind-powered sea vessel that has left France on a voyage to Japan. NHK Japan.
Health authorities in China reported 114 more deaths from the new coronavirus on Wednesday, mostly in the province of Hubei. That brings the total number of fatalities in the mainland to 2,118. Authorities also said 394 new cases were reported in the country, bringing the total number of patients to 74,576. This was the first time since January 26th that the number of new cases in a day fell below 1,000. In the city of Wuhan, authorities conducted a 3-day campaign through Wednesday to screen residents for symptoms such as fever. The aim is to stop the outbreak from spreading further by making sure everyone with symptoms is accepted at hospitals or quarantined in other ways. Japan's government plans to re-examine its handling of the mass infection of the new coronavirus aboard the cruise ship Diamond Princess. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention pointed out that some passengers had been placed at high risk of infection. Japan's opposition political parties have also criticized the government's response. Health Minister Katsunobu Kato has explained that the government has made maximum effort to prevent infection among those on board. The World Health Organization has also noted that Japanese authorities have been taking necessary measures. The government says it will continue efforts to contain the spread of the virus and review its actions when the outbreak is seen to be under control. It will also consider initiatives to create an international framework for cooperation in dealing with such situations.
The British government plans not to issue visas for foreign workers who fail to meet a standard in a points-based immigration system. The government has unveiled an outline of the new immigration system to be introduced next January, when free movement ends following Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. The outline says points will be given to foreign people who want to work in Britain in accordance with their skills, qualifications, salary, proficiency in English, and other factors. Visas will not be issued in principle to those who fail to achieve a certain score. The minimum annual salary for those workers will be set at £25,600, or about $33,000. The standards will be applied to workers not just from EU member countries, but also from outside the bloc. The government says 70% of workers from EU countries currently do not meet the new standards.
Britain has urged Japan to raise its reduction target for greenhouse gas emissions ahead of a UN climate change conference later this year. All members of the Paris Agreement are required to submit their new reduction targets to the United Nations by the end of this month. The agreement aims to cut global emissions as quickly as possible and cut them to virtually zero by 2050 or later. Japan has yet to make clear whether to raise its target of cutting the country's greenhouse gas emissions by 26% from fiscal 2013 levels by fiscal 2030. Britain's envoy to this year's United Nations Climate Change Conference spoke to NHK in Tokyo on Monday. John Merton noted that Britain has achieved both emissions reductions and economic growth by concentrating investments into renewable energy sources. He stressed that Japan has to invest in renewables in order to make sure that its industry has access to cheap electricity. The envoy also commented on Japan's policy to help other countries build coal-fired thermal power plants. He said that helping the economies of Southeast Asia get addicted to coal is not necessarily a productive step in the fight against climate change.
The world's first vessel that generates its own power is preparing to set off on a voyage from France to Japan. The Energy Observer uses a combination of renewable energies. It has solar panels, sails, and a modified version of the hydrogen cells used in Toyota's Mirai car. The system uses solar and wind power to extract hydrogen from seawater. Local residents and supporters were given a look at the craft in Saint-Malo in northwestern France. Victorien Erussard, the captain of the Energy Observer, says he hopes the voyage to the other side of the world will accelerate the development of hydrogen technology. The Energy Observer will be crossing the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The crew is aiming to arrive in Japan in late July.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6155-7410 or 9860, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes reports on the compounding effects of climate change, specifically the forced migration of people due to more frequent and intense storms, floods, droughts, and heat waves. An update on the war that never stopped on Yemen, where at least 31 civilians were killed by Saudi airstrikes last weekend. Spanish National Radio.
Last week, Global Risk Intelligence published its top global risks of 2020, entitled The Compounding Effects of Climate Change. The following comes from its segment on migrations. One of the most important climate-related social developments to consider is that climate change will force people to relocate. Millions of people around the world will migrate due to more frequent and intense storms, floods, droughts, and heat waves. Such large-scale movement of people will affect economies, state governments, international security, and national resource management. Environmental changes and natural disasters have influenced human settlement patterns throughout history. Yet climate change today may cause a rapid increase in human migration that could last for decades. The World Bank projects that approximately 143 million people will resettle by 2050 if no climate action is taken. In sub-Saharan Africa, that's 86 million people, South Asia, 40 million, and Latin America, 17 million people. The risks report continues. Climate-related migration will significantly weaken economic productivity. Estimations suggest that South Asia's economy, for instance, may expect a loss of 1.8% of annual GDP by 2050 due to climate change. Large-scale migration will also put stress on international security and border control, potentially causing violent conflict. This may be aggravated by intra- and interstate competition for food, water, and other resources. Currently in Africa, one out of every three people faces water scarcity, and climate change increases the chance of drought. In order to manage the risks of climate-related migration, the United Nations recommends that the availability and flexibility of channels for regular migration be improved. Planned relocations of communities and villages can enhance safety and reduce the unstructured diffusion of people. This requires long-term planning and domestic and international logistical cooperation. And now from Top Issues to Watch in Africa 2020, published by the Covington firm in their section on climate. The 2019 UN Climate Change Conference, COP25, failed, and Africa has the most to lose. Though Africa accounts for less than 4% of carbon emissions globally, it is extremely vulnerable to climate change scenarios above 1.5 degrees Celsius. The continent is vulnerable because sub-Saharan Africa has 95% of rain-fed agriculture globally, and agriculture accounts for a large share of the region's GDP and employment. In fact, the two most extensive land-based end-of-century projected decreases in rainfall occur over Africa, one over North Africa and the other over Southern Africa. Finally, the capacity of African nations to adapt to climate change is relatively low given the effects of poverty, which reduces choice at the individual level. And as the new World Social Report indicates, people living in the European Union have an average income that's 11 times higher than that of sub-Saharan Africa, and the disparity grows to 16 times higher when compared with North Americans. Extreme weather and environmental degradation are adding to economic shocks, and rising temperatures already have made the ratio between the income of the richest and the poorest 10% of the global population some 25% larger than it would be in a world without global warming. The war in Yemen took a deadly turn in March 2015 when the Saudi-led Sunni Muslim coalition intervened and began its airstrike campaign after the Houthi rebels ousted the Saudi-backed government from power in the capital Sana'a in 2014. Since that time, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states in the coalition have become the world's largest arms importers. In 2018, Saudi Arabia spent more than $70 billion on weapons, nearly 9% of its GDP. The United States is by far its biggest supplier, with about 70% of the market between 2014 and 2018, with the United Kingdom the second biggest, accounting for about a tenth of total Saudi purchases. Spain follows in fourth place. According to one respected database, at least 100,000 people have been killed in the war in Yemen since 2015. That includes 12,000 civilians in directly targeted attacks. The count for 2019 was 20,000 dead due to fighting. The data covers everything from airstrikes, shelling, and ground battles between the various forces to militant bombings and violence at protests. The numbers do not include people who have died in humanitarian disasters caused by the war, particularly starvation. Other sources have provided higher estimates of the death toll. Over the weekend, at least 31 people, including civilians, were killed in airstrikes. The Houthi rebels accused the Saudi-led coalition of carrying out the strikes in retaliation for the downing of a Saudi Tornado jet. The United Nations office in Yemen said preliminary field reports indicated that as many as 31 civilians were killed and 12 others injured in strikes that hit Al-Hayyaja area in the Al-Jawaf province. The Saudi-led coalition said the tornado jet had crashed in Al-Jawaf. There was no independent verification of the airstrikes or tornado drumming.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. A U.S. federal judge ruled a mistrial in the case against the Embassy of Venezuela Protectors Collective. Four people who tried to prevent the embassy from being occupied by envoys of self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido. The Venezuelan communications minister has presented new evidence on a series of corruption acts involving Juan Guaido, including money laundering. The WikiLeaks Twitter account has been blocked a few days before the extradition hearing of Julian Assange begins in the UK. Assange has been moved from solitary confinement after other prisoners at Belmarsh Prison staged a protest. Radio Havana, Cuba.
In Washington, D.C., U.S. Judge Beryl Howell declared mistrial against the Embassy of Venezuela Protectors Collective after the jury could not reach a verdict. The judge even gave the jury extra time to deliberate. However, they could not reach a unanimous decision. Howell asked for a new trial, but there is still no certainty that it will happen. The four activists, Adrienne Pine, David Paul, Kevin Zies, and Margaret Flowers, were arrested in May 2019 after being accused of interfering with the functions of the U.S. Department of State for staying at the Venezuela's embassy in Washington. They were trying to prevent the administration of Donald Trump from giving the headquarters to the envoys of Venezuelan self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido. During the trial, Judge Howard refused to allow the defense to present its evidence and even claimed that she considered it was U.S. President Donald Trump's decision who the president of Venezuela was. The Venezuelan government, led by Nicolas Maduro, repeatedly declared that the activists were their guests and they were legally allowed to be there, so their detention represented a transgression of international laws that protect the inviolability of diplomatic facilities. Venezuela's Communications Minister Jorge Rodriguez has presented new evidence on a series of corruption acts in which the U.S.-backed opposition lawmaker Juan Guaido is the main protagonist. Rodriguez unveiled the corruption case linking Guaido with Alejandro Betancur López, who faces trials for laundering $1.2 billion in the United States and $4 billion in Europe. Since the opposition lawmaker has repeatedly denied having ties with such a businessman, Rodriguez showed photos of a meeting held in the Alamein Castle in Spain, which was attended by Betancur López, Juan Guaido's father, and Rudy Giuliani, who is President Donald Trump's lawyer. Minister Rodriguez recalled that some details of this information had been previously published by Reuters and CNN, although the press would appear not to show that plot of personal connections. The Bolivarian minister also indicated that his country has sued the U.S. government for the theft of foreign assets and bank deposits. The looting equals up to $116 billion.
WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Christian Refsnan has reported that the WikiLeaks Twitter account has been locked shortly before the Assange extradition hearing begins, and for no apparent reason, in a post from his personal account, lamenting that he has been unable to reach a human at Twitter for answers. Refsnan tagged both the platform's tech support and CEO Jack Dorsey. The WikiLeaks account most recent post concerned the dire precedent set by extraditing a publisher to stand trial on espionage charges. Assange's extradition hearing in the UK is divided into two parts, set to begin on Monday, February 24th, while the second half is scheduled for May. The publisher's lawyers have complained that access to their client is being restricted, and Assange was only recently moved from solitary confinement at the Belmarsh prison in London after his fellow inmates staged a protest. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niles Melzer, after examining the activist last year, has accused the UK government of contributing to the psychological torture of Assange.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well most of this week at their website, radiohc.cu, and their podcast links worked one day. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support it. Through PayPal, you can create a monthly subscription to help cover my expenses. We will conclude with Russia's Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with Bhutania Shaban, political advisor to Syrian President Bashar Assad. She discusses the Syrian army's Idlib offensive, allegations of Russian and Syrian targeting of civilians in the offensive, continuing fake Western news, what she sees as President Erdogan's Ottoman Empire revival, and the elimination of indigenous Arab peoples and cultures in the Middle East. Sputnik Radio.
We can go straight to Damascus and join via Skype Dr. Bethena Shaban, political advisor to the Syrian government. Why has it taken you so long to liberate Idlib from al-Qaeda-linked groups there in your country?
There are so many terrorists in Idlib who came across Turkey, and in the last 2 weeks we have been liberating a huge part of rural Idlib, many villages, many places, and also our army has secured Aleppo that has been since 2016 particularly subjected to missiles and attacks from Jabhat al-Nusra, which is called now Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is a terrorist organization. We are determined to liberate Idlib and the rest of Syria from both terrorism and occupiers.
Every broadcast on media in NATO nations claims you are killing women and children. 1 million women and children are the numbers that are being quoted on, say, CNN, Channel 4 News, the BBC here. 80% of them women and children. Your actions over the past 10 weeks have caused that. Syrian and Russian warplanes are killing all these women and children.
I actually, Afshin, wish they were here to see what was happening on Western Aleppo, in rural Aleppo, and in rural Idlib, and to see the what these terrorists left behind. They left their black flags, all their mottos, all what they wrote on the stones, on the walls, show that they are Jabhat al-Nusra, that they are Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, that they are the branch of al-Qaeda, and that they are terrorists. What is amazing, Afshin, is that every time the Syrian army overcomes terrorists anywhere in Syria, the Western world speaks about killing civilians and killing women and children, while they never mention the tens of thousands of martyrs who were killed by the missiles of the terrorists. Do the Western governments support these terrorists? Do they like them? Do they want them to prevail? Only when the terrorists are defeated that Pompeo or Western or European officials call for stopping the Syrian army because civilians are being killed. It is the time when civilians are being saved. It is a time when women and children and factories and institutions are being saved from terrorism.
Okay, but even if one accepts that Boris Johnson, Donald Trump are backing al-Qaeda-linked groups in Damascus, al-Qaeda-linked groups still have children. What about the children in these groups that you're saying that you're liberating? Is there no alternative but for them to be killed in the liberation of these areas?
In all the picture that we saw, our army was fighting terrorists. There were no children in the areas where our army is fighting. And we definitely do not target any women or any children. It targets only the terrorists. But if the Western governments care about women and children, they should at least acknowledge the reality, and they should stop the measures they take against Syrian women and children, which are preventing us from having our food, our medicine, our ordinary life, our movement. It is the West who is imposing the worst kind of lives on Syrian women and children.
But on British television, on Channel 4 News, on CNN, on ITV here in Britain, there is video evidence purportedly showing the bombing by Russia or by Syria of children, the murder of children.
that's not true. Well, there are so many videos, you know, in OPCW, we discovered how much the media was fake with the white helmets who got the Oscar. We discovered that they were the right hand of the terrorist. Now you have a film being shown in London by Waad Al-Khatib, who is from Aleppo. It is a fake film that has no grain of truth in it, that has been made only in order to grant the woman and her family residency in Britain at the expense of the truth. Fake media now is a real issue that we should all face in order to discover the reality and what is truly going on, not only in Syria, but everywhere in the world. Why doesn't Western media come to Syria and find out truly what's happening? We are neighbors with the Turkish people, but I will tell you that Erdogan was a spearhead of all this terrorist war that has taken place in Syria. Without him allowing all these terrorists to cross the borders, it would have been impossible to make all these terrorists come to Syria. And now that he has failed in Syria, he is moving his terrorist war into Libya. I think Erdogan is a very dangerous man because of two factors. First is that he thinks he will restore the Ottoman Empire. And second, because he is a Muslim brother and he is feeding Muslim Brotherhood, not only in the Middle East, but also in Europe and in Asia and anywhere he can feed them.
Last time in Damascus, you told me this is not even about President Assad. This is about destroying the identity of Syria itself.
That's very true, Afshin. When you see the destruction that has taken place in Aleppo, you know, the railway, the old houses, the things that are classified as a human treasure, it is about the destruction of the identity of Syria. And if you link this to the statement of Netanyahu 2 days ago saying that we will prevail in the region and in the world, you will conclude, as I conclude, that what they are doing is trying to destroy the indigenous Arab people in this region in the hope of dissolving the Palestinian problem and in prevailing over the region and destroying the Arab culture.
Dr. Bethana Shaban, thank you.
That interview was from Afshin Mirtansi's program, Going Underground, heard on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available 3 times a week at rt.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast, get a global perspective. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's simpler than you might think, except for the interference that electronic devices make. If you use the internet, listening globally is even easier and noise-free. See the links at this program's website. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website, along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 23rd year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.